A professorial lecture is a nice opportunity to pull together strands of work in a field where you don't have to be technical, you don't have to be trying to reach out to a broader audience. And certainly Sussex has a long tradition in multidisciplinary teaching, multidisciplinary research, so I'm going to try to kind of be a bit broad, certainly broader than just narrow economics. And then so is the IDS, where I now have a joint appointment. Indeed, in the IDS, economics is a minority, indeed an endangered species. And then on arrival at Sussex 2 years ago, I was asked by Lawrence Haddad to give a lecture in the development series, which I did, and I tried to be multidisciplinary across talking about economic systems. And I asked the dean whether I could count that is my professorial lecture, and he said, absolutely not. That doesn't count at all, and you have to start all over again. So that's what this is. That's what I'm going to be doing. This year, I actually asked the director of the IDS whether we could count this as a development lecture in addition, and I was told, absolutely not. And in fact, the development lecturer was Kamal Dervis last week, who did a wonderful job. It's going to be a hard act to follow. My topic is broad. It's potential drivers of economic development. Here's more or less what I'm going to cover. I'm going to delve into economic history, what's modern economic growth, and I'll look into history a lot. I have reached an age I find somewhat distressing that what I'm calling history, I seem to remember a lot of it. And I will be working to distinguish growth and development. Growth is something economists have studied for a long time, and also with lots of history in that. Development is more complex, and I'll be spending some time trying to distinguish the notion of development from the notion of growth. And I'll be thinking of it as a process, so you'll get some history of that. I'll also take absolutely unapologetically an economy-wide perspective. A lot of economics these days has gotten very micro. We look into how households work, how firms work. I'm going to stand back and take a national and international perspective. So very kind of complementary, I would argue, to the microanalysis, but very different. And I'll also be careful to try and define terms as we go along. So with that, let me start. And I'll start with some economic history. This is the notion of economic epochs, long periods, characterized by the working out of what Simon Kuznets calls an epochal innovation. For example, he looked at the 300 years of what he called the commercial age, where the innovation was transportation and communications technology. The major driver was the development of the efficient, economic, long-distance sailing ship. And you can see the growth of trade patterns and the working out of that process for a long period. Kuznets, looking at the Industrial Revolution and the period since that, calls it modern economic growth. So it's roughly somewhere around 1800 to the present and still running. The epochal innovation, the application of science to the problems of production. Note the emphasis on application. So Kuznets' engineering is at least as important as science. And there was a dynamic going on, an interaction between economic rewards, returns, and further induced technological change. So what drove this? Well, clearly, the development of basic science. That's crucial. And then the invention and commercial development of new methods of production, the application of that science to problems of production. The development and inexpensive sources of energy. So really dramatic during the period, starting with the steam and then the internal combustion engine, petroleum, and electricity. If I had to pick a single indicator of human progress, just one number, I suspect you would do very well by just looking at the amount of energy used per laborer. And then also you had the development of capital goods, which basically embody the technology and embody the energy. Think of somebody sitting on top of a giant road machine, you know, some single person cleaning out hillsides, that sort of thing. The process was characterized by economies of scale, and specialization in economies of scale, what Adam Smith studied in the late 1700s. There are a lot of linkages in these processes. So you made things cheaper, and then the processes that used those things were able to work more efficiently. A whole bunch of commodities went from being very expensive to being very cheap. So you had a dramatic, what might be called commodification of things like steel, energy, intermediate inputs, later chemicals. These things became widely used and cheap. Dramatic structural changes in production, basically industrialization and the relative decline of agriculture. Indeed, for a long time, and certainly in my education, modern economic growth and industrialization were considered synonymous. But always, technical change across the board. Technical change in agriculture was a crucial driver of economic development, or modern economic growth. Could not have achieved modern economic growth without that. And also major institutional changes in the way, in the organization of production, the way the factory system you can think of, the way corporations work. You also had associated with it dramatic demographic changes. Rapid population growth, rapid urbanization, rural urban migration, and they went with this process. Organizing production in cities seems to be a very crucial part of it. That also carries with it other major forces that you needed to have to go along with it. For example, the development of public health. It's not widely known, but cities were net consumers of people through most of the 19th century. Cities killed more people than they were born, and the only way you could keep them going was through migration. Well, if you end up with 80% of the people in cities, that's not sustainable. So public health was a crucial part of that process. The other point about it is that the process works by making things cheaper. Indeed, that's the whole point of it. So agriculture, energy, metals, chemicals, all these things became cheaper. Therefore, when we look at an overemphasis on the terms of trade, the fact that things people sell are becoming cheaper and some people lose, that's probably a misplaced focus for a lot of this. You really do need to think about it in the terms of that's where the progress comes. Well, we need to think about what drove this or what theories of growth, and that's a hard thing. We do it a lot in economics. There's a lot of math spent on this, and we would like to come up with what we might call as necessary and sufficient conditions for growth. Elegant theory, but history is much noisier than that, unfortunately, and much messier. There seem to be conditions, but you can kind of substitute among the conditions, and there's a literature on that in the economic history. One thing you might strive for is come up with a kind of list of conditions for growth that worked. We study history, we see modern economic growth. It's a dramatic process where we see it. It did occur. If we can describe it well, we can do a good job at that. Can we describe it so tightly that if we missed something, the growth wouldn't have occurred? Can we do that? What I call analytic history as opposed to narrative history. You're trying to weigh the importance of different factors. There's a long history of that in economics. I'm going to be a little bit less ambitious tonight because that turns out to be a minefield in terms of economics. There's still very active debates going on about that. I will suffice if I can just identify the major drivers. So what is it that really makes this process work? How does it happen? And then lurking behind it, how can we make it happen? A very different idea. And that is the notion of development strategies. So those are the two themes. How does it happen? How can we make it happen? Well, early theories of modern economic growth, Joseph Schumpeter was a major role in this. And he had a vision of the role of innovation. And he described five sources of innovation. Introduction of new goods, new methods of production, technology, opening new markets. The economies of scale are determined by the size of markets. Conquest of a new source of supply of raw materials. That's a very 19th century notion, of course. We don't do that kind of thing anymore. And then carrying out a new organization of industry. Schumpeter was kind of sticking within the kind of economics view, but he did have very views about how industrial organization worked. Can we discern among sorts of views some notions of necessary conditions? Well, maybe some. Basically, economic growth is about making money. I mean, if you can figure out a way to do things that make money, you are going to have growth. So profitable opportunities must exist. What their source is something we can study, but they have to exist. Then you have to have people, groups of people or individuals who want to exploit those opportunities. So that has a couple of dimensions. One, they have to know about it. They have to be aware that such possibilities exist. If you're ignorant of the possibilities, ignorant in the sense that you're not even aware they're there, you're not going to do anything about it. And then information on risk also. Profitable opportunities are risky, and how do you manage the risk part of it? And then second, you have to be motivated to want to do something about it. And a major theme, of course, in the history of the Industrial Revolution was the role of such motivation. There's a literature on the role of religion, that you had to have the Protestant Reformation before you could actually have economic growth. And then second, you've got to be able to divert adequate resources to invest in these opportunities. These things cost money to do. You have to build factories. You have to be able to divert resources from current consumption to invest. Opportunity, motive, ability. It sounds a little bit like a detective story, and some elements of it is. Can we think about what makes societies run and classify, and this is pretty descriptive, classify societal structures or forces in terms of how they contribute to modern economic growth? That's what I'm looking for. One way of thinking about that is that you can think of these societal structures, we can classify them into basically three categories of forces at work. Facilitators that facilitate modern economic growth, inhibitors that inhibit it, concomitants or things that kind of go along but neither help or hurt. They seem to be part of the process, but they don't seem to drive it, nor do they hinder it. And the idea would be, can we identify necessary facilitators? Can we identify things that kill the process, without which the process dies? And can we look through history and come up with mixes of these forces where some mixes work and some mixes don't work, and we're missing things? So clearly, a necessary facilitator is the Kuznets' epochal innovation. It is the application of science to the problems of production. If you don't have that, you don't have modern economic growth. You also have to increase investment. You have to be able to divert resources from current consumption to build up the capital stock, because it's that capital stock that embodies knowledge and the application of energy. And you need a certain amount of infrastructure to do that. You need to create integrated markets. So, for example, in the United States, a major, major driver of modern economic growth in the United States in the early 19th century was the building of the Erie Canal that opened up the western grain-producing part of the country to eastern and world markets and tied together a national economy. You also need institutional innovation. The institutions of the 18th century were not satisfactory for the 19th century. So you have to have different changes in the legal system, changes in the financial system. The role of government changes dramatically. You can think of inhibitors to growth. Well, I mean, obvious killer inhibitor is war. I mean, it's very hard to have any kind of growth in a war-torn society. But incomplete markets, places where just markets don't exist. You cannot move goods from one place to a market economically. That's a major inhibitor to growth. We have a whole literature on poverty as an inhibitor to growth, vicious circles of poverty. If the society is poor, it can't save. If it can't save, it can't invest. If it can't invest, it can't grow. So you actually observe these vicious circles. Culture, lack of motivation has been talked about in history. Again, the Weber thesis about the role of the Protestant Reformation. Societies that don't value growth or don't value innovation will not grow. You can also see the role of government. Failed states, clearly. We have a notion as a facilitator of growth, the developmental state, and there's literature on that. The converse, a failed state, is definitely a killer inhibitor. And then you also have things that might be concomitants. For example, I think in the 19th century and up through pretty much late 20th century, environmental degradation was a concomitant to growth. It neither helped nor hurt. Once it was a market failure for sure, and once you got rich enough and you could organize politically enough to deal with the market failures, the country started dealing with environment. So you cleaned up the air in London, and you have the Clean Air Act in the United States, and a whole delicate political process of pushing environmental issues beyond what the original markets would do. Fine, that's kind of economics. I haven't pushed beyond economics much traditional economics. But it's also true that modern economic growth is associated with dramatic changes in institutions. So all the systems that you can think of in a society are changed dramatically by the process. And I'll use the term economic development as modern economic growth plus all this other stuff. And we'll talk a little bit about what that is. This is where an economist starts getting to be uncomfortable. And I look for inspiration in leading me through this thicket. And in my case, it was Talcott Parsons, who was at Harvard when I was a graduate student, and Neil Smeltzer, who was a student of Parsons and then was a colleague at the University of California, did a whole bunch of literature on economic sociology. They wrote a very famous book called Economy and Society. They have a basically theory of social systems and economic institutions whose change can be drivers of societal change. More recently, we have in economics what's called new institutional economics. Douglas North is a leading proponent of this. Mansur Olson was another. This new book by Doug North, Understanding the Process of Economic Change, I would commend to you. It summarizes a great deal of his history, his views of these. He's very careful. I'm calling this growth. He calls it economic change. Somehow, there is a sense of growth and development has an inexorable going up. And in fact, there's a literature on takeoffs into growth, which gives you this metaphor of an airplane taking off, right? North is a little bit more careful, and he's seeing the changes. No, it's no requirement in North that the changes be for the better. So we should probably be changing the metaphors a little bit. I'll use a Parsons diagram where we can look at a social system as consisting of various structures, social structures, personality structures, institutional structures, and economic structures. And there's a whole sociological literature about what these structures look like. To an economist, this personality structure really is education and tastes, consists of human capital, culture, attitudes. What we get out of that in narrowly defined economics is a set of demand functions, how you behave in various markets, and that's really all we look for. In a theory of development, you look further. Social structures, societal norms, political rights, things like that. Same institutional structures would be legal systems, government, kind of religious institutions, educational institutions. And the economic structures you could think of as a set of isms, right? Capitalism, socialism, state, fascism, whatever kinds of isms that describe economic systems. They define a policy environment. And you also have markets and structures. Markets, free markets, controlled markets, regulation and property rights, dispute resolution, all those kinds of rules of the game for an economic system, and also the state of technology, resources and technology. What do you have available to you? What North then does is take this system, and he sees economic institutions, that the evolution of institutions comes from a tension, and this word tension shows up a lot in the economic history literature, between what's possible given these new technologies and what's feasible given existing institutions. And then he has a whole theory about how institutions evolve to take care of the new opportunities, and he has an elaborate discussion of how institutions evolve, how they get stuck, how they don't evolve, how there's inertia in these systems, how history matters. Leaving that aside, you could think of economic growth then, or economic development perhaps, is tension and then resolution. Tension is what happens because you have in a system agents or individuals, groups, perceive potential profit. It's arising between the present economic structure or ways that structure that can be changed that they can see is possible. And there's no point in dreaming about an economic structure that can't be done. Perception's important. You've got to think of what, again, ignorance and risk matters. But you can really think of this as extending Schumpeter. We can change this system by banging away at the institutions. And again, you can do it, you can have good and bad. And there's a literature on that of tension that doesn't work. But you can think of growth then as a successful resolution of tension. The actors respond to the tension by doing something. They change the institutions. The process is clearly messy. Schumpeter talks of creative destruction. So whenever you introduce an innovation, there are going to be a whole bunch of firms that are going to go out of business. There's a whole bunch of capital that's going to suddenly be obsolete. Think of the opening up of Eastern Europe, where the capital stock of Eastern Europe basically became obsolete overnight. You can think of lots of examples in economic history. So, for example, the creation of the insurance industry really started in response to the commercial age, where you had these sailing ships going out. They made a lot of money if they came back with a cargo, but you lost it all if the ship got caught in a storm. So what you created was a way to spread the risk. So no individual ship owner had to take all the risk. You could spread it among a collection of ship owners, share the profits, and create modern insurance and Lloyd's. You think of creating limited liability companies or joint stock companies as ways to run a modern economy and also create investment opportunities where you could pull together a lot of capital stock. Creation of financial institutions would be true of that. The process is messy. There are winners and losers. There are high adjustment costs. I mean, these transformations of a society are not free. It's a bit mysterious. We don't exactly understand what makes it start. There's a long debate about why the Industrial Revolution started in Britain, and you can think of stories of why didn't the Romans manage this. It also seems to be a bit delicate. We would like to think of it as an inexorable progress, but we can see many examples where it collapses, where it doesn't work. To think about that, if you look at early modern economic growth, 19th century to the early 20th century, you could see that by World War I, the system was in a mess. It was periodic financial crises, you had boom depression cycles, you had class warfare, this is where Marx made his name, and you basically had a collapse, economic, political, and social crisis in the early 20th century. Two world wars, Great Depression, collapse of the international trading system. I would call this the Marxian crisis. That's a controversial notion. There's still a group of people out there, I think, will jump all over me for using the term Marxian crisis for this. But I would think two world wars, the Great Depression, and the complete collapse of the international trading system and the world financial system, that qualifies as a system collapse in my way of thinking. How is it resolved? And that's what really determines what's going on now, the late 20th century. Well, we resolved it. We changed these Parsonian societal systems. We basically came up with three competing economic systems as you came to World War II and out of World War II. Reform capitalism, what my one version of it would be social democracy, fascism, and communism or state socialism as in the Leninist view of this. One point to note is they all worked. They all reformed. They all got you out of this crisis. They all performed pretty well economically. They started growth again. They certainly continued the process of industrialization that occurred, that was a characteristic of modern economic growth. Virulent fascism, think Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo, that was clearly unstable and failed. And it failed rather catastrophically in World War II. But in post-World War II societies, we basically see these all working. One of the other interesting to me, and I think rather looking back now, we weren't seeing it back 30 years ago, but we do see it now, is that the post-World War II societies basically developed a set of performance criteria for economic and political systems. It's quite interesting. I mean, quite widespread. These criteria, they really are emerging societal norms, really based on what a modern economy can do, and people can see it. I mean, they can see successes and compare them with what their society is doing for better or for worse. And these criteria would be clearly continued modern economic growth. If you don't keep growing, you are correctly viewed as not, as a failing economic system. Some part of that is macro stability, some significant degree of both economic and political freedom, some significant degree of social mobility, economic mobility, some acceptable levels of poverty reduction, if you will. Too much poverty is a definite killer inhibitor. Adequate social net, safety net. Some worry about relative wealth and income distributions. Too extreme or considered unstable. Major issue of management of risk, incidents and insurance of risk for people. You could think of these as being formalized in the UN Millennium Development Goals and being measured by things like the Human Development Indicators. They've evolved over a lot of the post-war period. Human Development Indicators have their roots here at IDS, in fact, and here at Sussex. It's actually utterly fascinating to me that the UN system has come up with the Millennium Development Goals as an articulation of these performance standards. Clearly different societies, different countries weigh them differently. They tolerate more inequality or less inequality. I mean, there's nothing uniform about this. But I think they're all there. And you can see that among the drivers of growth in this period, the systems need to provide shock absorbers. It's a nasty business. It's got a lot of noise in it and a lot of creative destruction. And you need to provide mechanisms, institutional mechanisms, that basically ameliorate the impact of these societal changes. So that seems to be a necessary part of the process, safety nets, institutions to manage risk. That seems to be now, I think, an important part of the facilitators of the process. You need to subsidize or help factor mobility, which is a part of that, and manage the process in a way. We expect governments to take a much more active role than we did before World War II. So with that in mind, and this notion of these performance criteria being a very important part of the development process in which distinguishes development from modern economic growth, I mean, if we can view modern economic growth, or at least the early modern economic growth failed spectacularly with the Great Depression, now we're into the next type, these criteria have become important. So if you look at the basically post-World War II period, think about countries as a group, as a universe, and you can think of typologies of countries. We have the post-industrial mature economies, the OECD countries, the old industrial economies. They basically arrived. They've undergrown modern economic growth, MEG we call it here, for a long period. They've done sustained economic development. and they've kind of arrived. You clearly have industrializing economies that are in the middle of the process. Various countries in Asia and Latin America, and you can think of South Africa, possibly China, India seems to be now going along. What the World Bank would call middle-income countries, probably the countries of the middle-income countries of Eastern Europe that are now joining the EU. They're all characterized by both rapid growth and rapid structural change. And they've been undergoing this modern economic growth. It's quite identifiable and going on for some time. Then we have something a little vaguer, these pre-modern economic growth countries that seem to be in process of achieving important facilitators, eliminating inhibitors. They look like they seem to be working in somewhere, getting the distinction between the second and third and the fourth is going to be a little bit hard, because you also have countries that are clearly failing. Whatever's going on, it isn't working. They are failing to achieve modern economic growth for whatever reason. And then finally, keep in the back of your mind that we have a collection of countries now in the world which I will call rentier economies. They're basically sitting on some primary resource like oil or minerals. They dig it up, they earn dollars, they invest the dollars, they are quite rich, but they are not undergoing any kind of modern economic growth. They're just simply living off their assets. They produce little. They live off the resources and the returns to past portfolio investments. They're certainly not undergoing modern economic growth, and I wouldn't want to include them in a comparison of countries that do. Now, can we think of development strategies for basically these two? I mean, what should these countries that are doing it right and seem to be going, and the countries that are doing it wrong, what can they do? So think of a development strategy. Now we're talking about how to make the process happen rather than just understanding it. Think a development strategy, it's an integrated package of policies. It's going to be nation states are the relevant actors here. It is going to be a coherent policy package. It's a good idea if the policies hang together. And the modern economic growth is the idea. You want to achieve productivity growth. You want to achieve investment. You want to achieve specialization economies of scale. And you want to do it over a long period, stably, sustainably. And you're going to accept that there's going to be major structural changes while you do this. It is going to be a messy process. There are going to be winners and losers as you move along. And you accept that and deal with it as you go along. If you look at the post-war period and that resolution of the Marxian crisis, you can see two major debates, two different broad strategies. Socialist versus market-based strategies, and then for a long period of time in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, import substitution versus open development strategies. Cold War was an important background of this. A lot of this was a clash of ideologies, and politics mattered. It certainly had a lot to do with aid policy and how you viewed these things. The socialist strategy certainly was a viable alternative. If you look in the early post-war period, far, far more many people in the world lived under socialism than did under anything like liberal economic policies. It was very successful in mobilizing resources. Socialist countries achieved investment rates that were just dramatic. They avoided the boom-bust crises and the macro crises. They did that very successfully. They provided shock absorbers. They met these standards. They definitely provided employment. In fact, it was illegal to change your jobs. Everybody was employed. What they failed completely to do was to achieve continued productivity growth and modern economic growth. There are a lot of stories about why, bureaucracy, perverse incentives. North has a very interesting discussion of the failure of these systems. Basically, they stifled all economic innovation. And we have measures of productivity growth. What's absolutely fascinating is looking at the socialist countries towards the end. These measures of total factor productivity growth were negative. So they were achieving some growth by just having enormous investment rates and wasting the capital stock they were building. The import substituting industrialization strategy was pretty much very widespread in the 50s and 60s, very characteristic of Latin America, but also across Asia. Again, it was linked to ideology. It was a view that modern economic growth is equal to industrialization. You have to achieve industrialization. How to do it? Protect your domestic markets and build up your industrial sector, just like the U.S. and Europe did in the 1800s. It worked in the sense that it achieved significant industrialization and aggregate growth for quite a period, certainly probably 15, 20 years of it. What became quite clear is it pursued too long. It just led to incredible inefficiency and stifled innovation. So it also failed. So those systems failed. Finally, by the 1980s, it was clear. And we have the kind of collapse of the social systems in the late 80s, 90s. We have Francis Fukuyama. We had the end of history, right? There's only one system left standing. It was kind of the capitalist development model and the open development strategy. And that led to a very Margaret Thatcher here and that kind of view of the world. It led to a narrowing of policy space. What governments could do was less. If you compare the policy space available to governments under a socialist system and under a completely open capitalist system, it's quite different. It also led to certain depoliticization of the notion of development strategies. The focus, one system left standing, the focus went very micro. Instead of these rather vituperative political debates, we went down and looked at household level, and the whole economics profession went very micro, very fast. A lot of focus on safety nets and those other performance criteria on the assumption that somehow the macro level was fixed. The export-led growth strategy, which turned out to be look so successful, was really started in Asia, the export-led East and Southeast Asia, Japan first, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, called the Gang of Four. Very strong role of international trade. There's a literature on stages of comparative advantage that said, well, you start out producing labor-intensive manufacturing and you work your way up to producing more and more industrial goods. It was very, very strongly industrialization-based. And it also did a lot of focus, ended up with a lot of focus on trade patterns around the world. So if you look at the early post-war period, you had in the 1950s basically a bipolar world. You had the U.S. and Europe. They traded a lot with one another, and they had their dependencies that traded primary goods to them and got manufacturing goods and back. In the U.S., it was Latin America and parts of Asia. In the EU, it was all of Africa and basically former colonies in Asia. There was a lot of literature on dependency theory coming out of that period, no surprise. That trading pattern broke up. Instead of being rigid and locked into place, leading to kind of an exploitation world system forever, it splintered. And what you had was the evolution of all kinds of trading blocks around the world, and a complete splintering of that system. And let me just give you a map that by the 1990s in this one, but even earlier, you had the world broken up into very different patterns. You have the U.S. and its periphery forming a trade bloc, the EU and its periphery, which now is expanded to include all of Eastern Europe and Russia. You have Mercosur showing up in Latin America as a trade bloc. You have the beginnings of a trade bloc in Africa, what's now called SACU, the Southern Africa Customs Union. It's not quite there. And then you had the emergence of this really significant trade bloc in East and Southeast Asia that was dramatic. Started early in the 70s, took off in the 80s and 90s. It now accounts for a larger, within bloc trade in that group is bigger than the trade of the U.S. It's a global behemoth in terms of the trade structure. And that trade is linked to, let me go back. That trade is linked to growth and structural change. And we see trade productivity growth links, trade investment growth links. What we've seen is enormous economic integration across these regions of the world. And I'm going to talk about shallow and deep briefly of this kinds of integration. Go back to the map. You can see enormous growth of intra-regional trade. So East Asia's share of world trade just in this 25, 26-year period goes from 5.4 to 18.7, and of it, intra-regional trade grows from 1 to 6.5. It goes up to being a third. That's an enormous change. It's an amazing shifts in total stuff. You also see an enormous increase in the growth of intermediate trade. So you have intra-regional trade growing dramatically. Here it is again as a share of GDP. Over just in 2002, you can see this enormous growth, 25% of intra-regional trade, of trade is intra-regional in East Asia and the Pacific, far higher than any of the other poor parts of the world. That part of the world is quite dramatic. You've also seen this dramatic increase in trade, but you've also seen a dramatic increase in intermediate trade. So of that trade, and this is just over a period of 10 years, the growth in a bunch of East Asian countries, the growth of trade in intermediate inputs, components, machinery and trade. Basically what you're observing in this period is a fragmentation of production processes. What at IDS we call value chains. Bits and pieces of goods are produced all over the place. They're assembled. Their stages of production are in different countries. They're traded all over the place. It's a fragmentation of production that is quite dramatic and unprecedented in terms of looking back at history. And it's been a major driver of growth in East and Southeast Asia. Why? Where did it come from? Clearly, lower transactions costs. It's transportation's cheaper, communications is much cheaper, computers make an enormous difference. The ability to set standards is a dramatic part of this. It's astounding when you think about it, that you can buy a hard drive from one country and a box from another and a motherboard from some place, completely different manufacturers of all these bits and pieces. You can put it together in your basement, creating a computer which has the finest production tolerances of any machinery ever done in this world, and you can do it in your basement. That's an amazing process. So that implies a whole bunch of technology and standards. It also implies, it wouldn't have happened in a world where you hadn't had liberalization of trade over a long period. Since World War II, there have been a series of trade negotiations under the General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade under GATT, which basically liberalized world trade. That matters a lot. It made this thing possible at one level. You couldn't have had it without that. But what we're observing in this regionalization is this dispersion of production. What it really allows you to do, which is impressive, is it allows you to get local economies of scale. So instead of making hard drives for IBM, you can make hard drives for the entire computer industry. Instead of making bits and pieces of a car, an airbag sensor that only sells to Chevrolet, you now make it for the entire automobile industry. That sets loose all kinds of economies of scale, and you get these major externalities arising from that. And it really is a whole new world of trade productivity links. It applies to many more sectors in manufacturing. This is not just a manufacturing story. We see it in agriculture. We see it in horticulture and bits and pieces of agriculture. We see it in the service sector, outsourcing all kinds of services. You know, call centers is just the beginning of it. So it's much more widespread across more economic activity than the industrial part. It also requires much closer coordination. Just lowering tariffs isn't enough. The early trade agreements, which were a very important part of this process, basically achieved what we call negative integration. They just eliminated barriers. But what we're looking for is deep integration, institutions, standards that facilitate trade. And we can see that. We can see more capital and labor mobility. We can see national institutions emerging that facilitate trade. We can also see it in international institutions. There's been a bursting forth of regional trade agreements around the world, all over the place. I've been involved in a couple of those negotiations on NAFTA. It's again a messy process, but it is a process of integration. We have a group at Sussex that's looking at this, and we've developed what we call the Sussex Framework from the Economics Department. Michael Gasharek, Peter Holmes, Jim Rollo, and David Evans and I are involved in this. And we're basically applying it as a way of looking at regional trade agreements, in particular starting to look at the economic partnership agreements that the EU is now negotiating with a bunch of countries, and asking, are they trade friendly? Do they facilitate this process of integration and productivity growth, or do they not? I mean, we can certainly give you examples of both. And the idea is to try to make that happen in ways that facilitate trade. We can see a lot of institutional adaptation to this. Again, it's a whole new process of changing the way we organize work, the way we organize enterprises, the way government plays a role in this. So what do we look back at? As we look at the 20th century now, we can see, well, socialism failed. Early capitalism failed spectacularly. The import substituting industrialization strategies finally failed. Export-led growth worked, but it's different now. It's evolved into a different kind of integration of global productions. And basically, those old strategies are no longer feasible or even desirable. So there's a debate out there about poor developing countries joining the WTO, and should we leave them the policy space to do the kind of policies that Korea did, import substituting industrialization and protecting their domestic markets? The answer is it's probably not desirable. I mean, trying to protect your domestic market for clothing might make sense, but trying to protect your domestic market for little bits of clothing that need to be processed someplace else doesn't make any sense at all. So it's different. What are the lessons from Asia? Well, we certainly see important role of institutions in deep integration. The world has changed. There is a danger in economics, as in warfare, of having the generals fight the last war. And there's a danger in that in economics. We seem to be discussing as if we could do it the way it was done before. We can't. But we do need to manage the system. There are winners and losers. It's still messy. Keep in mind those societal performance criteria. We need to think about countries now in new typologies. Who can play in this game? How soon? What do they have to do? What's their policy strategies? Where are their regions? India is a very important piece of this story. What is India going to do now as it comes out? What's the role of trade agreements? I mean, formal governmental policies. What are the elements of trade agreements that promote this process versus hinder it? And we can see examples of both. Then, what do you do if you can't play the game? Perhaps Africa. So you can't get into this new game. What do you do? What are the nature of the impediments? Should you start a long-run process that says eventually you'll be able to play in this game and you need to start thinking about it, but you need to do something in between to manage your life? But standing on the sidelines is not an option anymore. This is a moving, dynamic process. Also, given the new players, do we need to rethink the global rules, the WTO, given that we understand now better than we did what's going on? And then thinking of those standards, we need to be thinking of new trade-offs. Think of the facilitators versus shock absorbers metaphor, if you will. Government resources are scarce. Some of these things are complementary. There's a whole literature, for example, on doing transfer programs that feed people conditional on their school attendance, which builds human capital and is clearly a facilitator. In India, there was a literature on this public works mode of anti-famine programs. You pay people during a famine period, and you classify a famine crisis, you pay people to build infrastructure projects. But you can also have problems where you overdo it. Transfer programs that basically take money away from investment. You may end up having a sort of narrowly micro-focused notion of a pro-poor development strategy that may end up being neither pro-poor nor a very successful development strategy. And you need, I think we need to think about that more than we have in the past. Then also, we have new challenges. I mean, the end, the 21st century has set forth some new challenges. One, which is really starting to become clear and starting to get noisy, is growing inequality. We are seeing serious increases of inequality. And it's not clear that these societal standards are going to work so well. We've been doing all this focus on poverty, and we've forgotten the top end of the distribution, which is getting seriously worse everywhere. We talk about the rise of the hyper-rich. Now, back in the 20s, we called them the filthy rich, and it was a much more value term. Maybe we should go back to that. Also, what we're finding is that this worsening distribution is that the notion we used to have of growth is necessary for poverty reduction. That's still true, no question. You will not have serious poverty reduction without serious growth. But the relationship has gotten harder. It takes more growth to achieve a certain level of poverty reduction than it did 30 years ago. That's because of this worsening distribution towards the hyper-rich, which we're observing across the spectrum, both developed and developing countries. That is a problem. We try to pretend it's not, but it is. It's not a class problem in the old Marxist sense. This is not capital versus labor. Different things are going on, and it needs to be looked at. Also, we have a world in which we have much denser world, and global public goods matter. So you have to, these development strategies have to operate in a more interdependent world. The obvious big one is global warming. It's been described in a recent report as the most colossal market failure of the century, of any century. In the past, we could get away with not worrying about the environment. We'll clean it up when we get richer, right? Can't do that anymore. Global warming is a global problem. The other point about it is, you can't fix it at any level other than global. Sitting around and worrying about your personal shock, you know, how much carbon you emit, and buying yourself a few carbon offsets is kind of nice. It's public awareness rising. But unless you sort out the U.S., the EU, China, India, Indonesia, and Brazil, forget it. Nothing else makes any difference at all. That's what the big numbers are. Also, we have public health issues that are very serious. I mean, we've forgotten avian flu, AIDS, those kinds of things. And also, pollution has become more international than it used to be. So again, this notion of waiting and dealing with it later is really not open to us. So where are we? Well, we clearly need continuing modern economic growth. We need it. That really is the driver. We haven't finished with Kuznets in this world. But we have to do it in a more complicated, globalized world, in a somewhat narrower policy space at the national level, need for much more international coordination and decision-making. We need to have these Parsonian structures need to evolve more. And finally, I would say history hasn't ended. There are, yes, we know some of these systems failed, but I don't think we've figured out the correct ism yet. What's interesting about the world is that there's a lot of variety out there. There are continued problems. I think financial crises is something we don't really understand, global financial crises. There's still many failures. The process is clearly mysterious still and delicate, but we have learned a lot. And finally, something for any university person to say, there's still a lot of research to do. Let me stop there.